Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Last week, Professor Bonner Ritchie delivered his final public lecture at Utah Valley University, wrapping up an illustrious academic career. But in addition to his considerable reputation as a master teacher, he's also well known for putting his expertise into peacemaking into practice. Today on the program, Ritchie is with us to talk about negotiation and conflict resolution in the Middle East. We had invited him to join us last week, but weather got in the way. Fortunately, he was gracious enough to reschedule, and he joins me in studio today. Dr. Ritchie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Jay Bonner Ritchie is Professor Emeritus of International Organizational Behavior at the Marriott School of Management at Brigham Young University. He's also a scholar in residence at Utah Valley University. He's received distinguished teaching awards at both the University of Michigan as well as BYU. He's consulted with corporations from General Motors to General Electric, and with governments from the Navajo tribe to Jordan. If you have questions or comments about conflict resolution, about his work, his writings, and his experience, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we're getting a firsthand account of life in Afghanistan. But first, Bonner Ritchie. Professor Ritchie, before we get to your work in peacemaking and in negotiation, I want to start with a turning point that you've written about in your commitment to peace. I understand you were living in Jerusalem and you drove the wrong way to Hebrew University, and you got a taste of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Maybe you can describe this encounter.
It was a great learning experience. One of my problems is I define things as fun that other people define as dangerous or scary. But I'd been spending the day in Tel Aviv interviewing, and I was a visiting scholar at the BYU Jerusalem Center, and I just arrived and came home and dropped my wife and son off at our apartment and headed back to the Jerusalem Center, but took a shortcut around the east rather than the west side of Hebrew University, and was met by a group of young Palestinian kids in the village of Isawiya who decided to throw rocks at my car. And it was a little bit scary.
And one of those stones went through the windshield. And cut you.
Yeah, 30 pieces of glass in my face and arm. But I finally developed the skills of backing my little Subaru up, and it wasn't my car. It was a university car. And going back home, my wife decided that I needed more care than she could provide. So we went to the hospital and cut out the pieces of glass and had a fun conversation, learned a lot about medical care in Jerusalem. And then I went back to the village a few days later to talk to the Mukhtar, the kind of mayor, and I asked Solim, I wanted to meet some of the kids who'd thrown the rocks. And
Why? Why did you want to meet these stone?
Because I wanted to understand. Understanding is so critical. Conflict for me is an opportunity to learn rather than a reason to fight. And with that, I wanted to get acquainted. I wanted to understand what they were doing and why. And the Mukhtar was a little suspicious, thought maybe I was out to get them and was vindictive. But eventually he found out what I'd been doing. I'd been doing development programs with East Jerusalem Community Center, who works with traumatized children from the Intifada, the uprising Palestinians. And he said he really appreciated what I'd been doing and was sorry that I was a victim. I was an unintended victim. So it brought a couple of the boys in, teenagers that had thrown the rocks, and asked them why. And they said they were very sorry that I was hurt, that certainly I was not the target. The car was. And one of the lasting comments was they liked me and appreciated what I was doing, but I had a car with yellow license plates, and everybody's got different color license plates, white, United Nations, and blue and green for Palestinian commercial and private, and white, and silver for Gaza, and red for police, and black for military. Everybody's got different color. And I had a car with Israeli plates, with yellow plates in a Palestinian village. And they said they really liked me and appreciated me, but the car deserved to die. And that was one of those lasting memories. The car was a symbol of oppression and opposition and denial of freedom and taking their land. And the car was a symbol that they could not accept, even though I was doing good things. So I learned to take a bus, to walk, to take a taxi, and to do other things rather than drive a car with yellow plates in a Palestinian village. And that really was, as you point out, the beginning of a different career for me.
You are an economist by training. You've studied labor issues and bargaining theory.
Only got a PhD in it.
only a PhD. So how does the peacemaking fit in to this research interest?
Well, when I was in graduate school at the University of California, I was trying to find a way to do something interesting, and there was no field for me. I'd just gotten out of the Army, where I had commanded nuclear weapons unit in Germany, the occupation army, and was preparing to blow up the Soviet Union, decided maybe I needed to learn more about people rather than armaments. And so I came back to graduate school and couldn't quite find a field. And labor economics seemed sort of close because it dealt with a compromise and bargaining theory and various things. And it was a good program at Berkeley. And besides, there was a fellowship to work on some projects in Oakland that would put me through school. So anyway, I finished my degree and went to teach at the University of Michigan, but didn't really want to be an economist. It was a fun background, but I wanted to deal with the human variable. I decided I really wanted to help people protect themselves from organizational abuse, institutional abuse, national, corporate, whatever. At Michigan, a new field was underway, organizational behavior and applied behavioral science that came out of psychology and sociology and economics and a lot of fields. So I went to the business school at Michigan to start teaching and build on that and be part of development of a new field that was really fun. So that was the transition from the labor relations, labor economics to organization behavior. And I arrived in Michigan just at the time of the Detroit riots in 1967.
And that got you very interested in civil rights.
Oh, yeah. Only got shot at four times. But it was a means of applying concepts that I'd learned. You know, I talked about in bargaining theory, negotiation, conflict resolution. And so it was a fun time to learn and develop and experiment and so forth.
Why is it so important to apply the theory? Why is it not enough to teach the theory?
Well, it's fun to teach. It really is. It's fun to help people learn and change their perception and see things in a new way and shift their paradigms. That's really exciting. That's a career that's very dear to me. But on top of that, I'm a kind of impatient, difficult person. And I wanted to try some of these things and see if they worked. I wanted to see if the things I was talking about really made any difference. I'm suspicious of people who only talk, and that includes myself many times. But I really wanted to test a hypothesis. I wanted to learn, and I get impatient. I didn't want to stay in one place more than a short period of time. I wanted to do something different. So I value variety. I love conflict. I love ambiguity. And I just needed a place to try a few things.
Speaking with Jay Bonner Ritchie, Professor Emeritus of International Organizational Behavior at the Marriott School of Management at BYU, also a scholar in residence at Utah Valley University. We're talking about diplomacy, about conflict resolution, and about peacemaking. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Bonner Ritchie, you grew up in the LDS Church. You maintain your faith in your religion, and in many ways, your faith has guided this commitment to peace and to peacemaking. Describe how your faith is intertwined with the peace-building part of your career.
It's interesting. I was born in Utah, in Salt Lake, and then when I was very young, my family, during World War II, moved to San Francisco. And so my teenage years in high school were in California. And And it was somewhere along the way that I decided that organizations can be very useful or very evil. And I learned that in my Mormon culture, that there's a real power to organizations. They can do wonderful things, but they can abuse and manipulate people in ways that are very, very destructive. A fundamental tenet is that when people get power, they often exercise unrighteous dominion, or power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely, that's not a new idea. But the principle is, I became intrigued, maybe even obsessed, with how organizations can be used for good or ill, and that really did come out of a highly organized religious system, but with an incredible emphasis on individual agency. So I wanted to learn. I wanted to understand. And I wanted to see why people become drunk with power, why they abuse and why they exploit. And, that was part of what led to my career interest. And clearly I defined my career interest as helping people protect themselves from abuse at every level.
You've written that, like many other Judeo-Christian sentiments, I assumed that the European Jews deserved a homeland. I didn't realize the cost of displacing the long-term inhabitants of Palestine. Maybe you can expand on that a little bit. As you enter this arena of, controversy, deep-seated violence, there's a lot of baggage in the Middle East. Why did you decide to wade into that arena?
Well, I was walking down the hall one day and passed a friend of mine, Omar Kader, who is a Palestinian who had immigrated. His family had immigrated to Utah in the late 30s. And Omar said, "I've got to go to Jerusalem next week. Would you like to go?" And I'm not a planner. I don't have goals. I'm a very spontaneous person. I just take advantage of process, opportunities to do interesting things. And I said, sure. And then I forgot about it. I didn't take it seriously. Got a call from a travel agency saying, "We have a ticket for you, round trip from Salt Lake to Tel Aviv. How do you want to pay for it?" And so then I realized he was serious. And so I paid for my ticket and went. And then while there, on a kind of informal trip, I met some of his relatives and people. I saw a home blown up because a 9-year-old child had thrown a rock at an Israeli jeep. And I thought, there's got to be a better way. I need to understand this world. I need to get into it in a way that sees why people are in this terribly tragic conflict mindset. So I started reading. I came back home, didn't do anything then. And then a short time later, I was walking down the hall again, and somebody said, "Gee, we've just finished the BYU Jerusalem Center. Would you like to go?" And I said, "Sure, sometime." Then I forgot about it, and then got a fax from the director of the center saying, "Delighted to learn that you and your family are moving to Jerusalem. What kind of housing do you need? How many kids?" and so forth. And I went back to the academic vice president and said, "You were serious, weren't you?" He said, "Yeah, weren't you?" I said, "Yes, but not now. Not a good time. I need to wait a while." Our youngest was a junior in high school and lots of commitments. Then we met with an LDS church leader who said, "Understand you're going to Jerusalem." And said, "Well, I haven't really decided." And he said, "Well, can you decide now? You need to go build bridges to the Palestinians." And I said, "Gee, that's interesting. Why me? I don't speak Arabic. I really don't know the culture." He says, "But you teach ethics and behavior and conflict management and change and how to be effective." And he says, "Those are useful skills, so you need to go teach, build bridges and teach." So we moved to Jerusalem, and that was in 1989. Then I've been back and forth dozens and dozens of times since, and I've lived there about 6 years, either in Jerusalem or Jordan or somewhere in the Middle East.
During your experience, you met with Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO. But his wife really made a statement that made an impression on you. What was the statement?
You've read about some of my trips. We were in Tunis in 1993, invited by the PLO to come over and meet and spend some time. And at a dinner one night, Suha Arafat, who had recently married Yasser Arafat, it was a late night dinner, about midnight, which is typical in that world. And I was sitting between Yasser Arafat and his new bride, Suha. And she asked me if if I knew why we were there. And I said, well, we do training programs and talk. You know. She said, yeah, it's more important than that. We've been invited by the government of Norway to come to Oslo and negotiate peace with the Israelis. And she said, it's time to change our paradigm. It's time to negotiate peace rather than continue conflict. And she said something that was very moving to me. She said, we're going to have children. And those children must grow up in peace in Palestine. She said, for years, Yasser Arafat has been married to the PLO. Now he's married to me, and things change. Anyway, so she gave me a metaphor of peace for the children, of changing a mindset. And that was a really moving experience for me. And they did go to Oslo and did negotiate an agreement. It hasn't been implemented completely, but it did change a lot of things. And it takes time. But I see progress every day in spite of much of the news. And I'm very optimistic. And that was a critical event. And spent a couple of weeks and worked with the PLO Executive Committee, helping them to prepare for the Oslo peace negotiations. And the criterion that Suha offered was absolutely critical, peace for the children.
Speaking with Jay Bonarici, he's a professor emeritus of international organizational behavior at BYU, also a scholar in residence at Utah Valley University. We're talking about peacemaking, about diplomacy, and about conflict resolution. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Utah Valley University Professor Bonarici is well known for his work in organizational behavior, leadership, and peace building. Today on the program, we're talking about what it takes to make peace and how to change the all-or-nothing paradigm into one of reasonable negotiation and compromise. Bonarici is with us in studio, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. And let's go to the phones. Marcy is joining us from Salt Lake City. Marcy, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. I'm a student at the University of Utah, actually studying conflict resolution education, and I was wondering for the professor what he thinks, with all of his studies in the Middle East and even here, are the best ways to teach young children conflict resolution, whether it's in the schools or in the homes or both.
Good question, Marcy. Thanks for the call. Bonarici, how to advise children in developing these conflict resolution skills?
It's a great question. My last major experience in the Middle East was a couple of years ago when the King of Jordan sponsored a peacemaking workshop for people who work with children. It was funded by the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi, who has lots of money, and we had 73 people from 23 different countries in the area, people who work with children, teachers or community leaders or government leaders or religious leaders, people who work. And our goal was to teach decision-making, critical thinking, leadership, and peacemaking skills, and to help them do that. And it was a really fun endeavor. The issue was kids and adults, everybody, really needs to have a theory of reconciliation rather than a theory of conflict. And it was fun for me to develop from conflict resolution to conflict management to peacemaking as a paradigm, as a metaphor, and to teach that people need to have interests rather than demands. So often we have demands, and demands are fun. You know, I demand money or justice or revenge or rewards, rather than my interest, which is living in a peaceful, fun world. So you teach people to value, to identify, to articulate, and to value interests. And what are you really interested in? And every time we deal with that, the interest is in a peaceful, a stable future. And when you get people talking about that, they change their paradigm. And I always have photographs of children. My wife is a wonderful photographer. We have thousands of photographs of children. I put these photographs up and say, you may beat each other up, but the children deserve better. And how can we help them? And so, you teach them how to play games. You bring kids and adults from different backgrounds together, and you play games where the consequences are not so great, but the opportunities for working together and understanding each other are really important. You teach listening skills. I've learned in teaching and in conflict resolution that you really need to listen rather than preach. And listening becomes critical. And kids aren't great at listening often. Teaching them listening skills, teaching that they cannot talk, they just have to ask a question and then be quiet and listen, is a wonderful exercise, even for little kids. It's hard to impose, but it's a wonderful thing. And they come out of it saying, gee, by listening, I can learn. We did a training program for children in Nazareth, sponsored by the United Nations one time. We brought together Palestinian children, Christian and Muslim children, Jewish children. And in that particular program, we had kids from Ireland, Catholic and Protestant kids from Northern Ireland. And we had them working together. We had them playing games, silly games, that got them acquainted with each other. And they learned that other kids had similar feelings and emotions and so forth. And then we had them draw pictures. And I've still got many of those pictures where they were talking about the first time in their life that they'd ever really talked to this other person from this other group and understood them, and that they wanted to have fun and they wanted to have peace and they wanted to get a job. And there's just an enormous number of ways that we can help people build bridges. And I have three fundamental metaphors that I use. One is building bridges. Understand both ends of the bridge. It's got to be two ways, never a one-way bridge. And you've got to understand the people or the issues on both ends. And then secondly is maps. I teach people to draw maps with south at the top and not call it upside down, to look at the world from somebody else's perspective. And so you get Palestinian kids to represent Jewish kids by looking at the world from their perspective, and vice versa, and Catholic kids from Northern Ireland to represent the Protestant kids. And then the third metaphor is children itself, the future, making the world better for the people who are now children, who will be the adults tomorrow, and having that as an overriding interest rather than revenge or demands. It's reconciliation and love and so forth.
Marcy, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Professor Ritchie, you prefer conflict management over resolution, conflict resolution. What's the difference there for you?
Well, for me, it was a three-stage transition. I saw that many people thought that they needed to eliminate conflict, that they need to eliminate differences. And I learned very early that we're not going to eliminate differences. We need to respect them rather than eliminate them. And the conflict was actually a positive force for change rather than something to be defeated or won or eliminated. And so you teach people to value the diversity and the different perspectives and to rejoice in it and to manage it rather than to eliminate it. And then the third stage is peacemaking, where you teach people not just to management in a sense of enduring it, but to use it as a resource for making the world better, a fun way. You know, we did that in developing a chocolate factory in the West Bank with Jewish and Israeli and Palestinian participants. A fun idea of a business where we work together, everybody makes money, do something interesting, rather than try and eliminate the conflict. You say, let's take our differences and make a diverse, fun world out of it.
801-355-TALK is our number. Speaking with Professor Bonner Ritchie, and let's go back to the phones. Peter is joining us from Bountiful. Peter, hi.
Good morning. I have a question for you. I love the Middle East. I've studied it quite a bit. The closest I've ever been there is Algeria. Someone recently asked me when I'm going to Israel, and I told them I didn't feel comfortable going there because of their human rights violations. Is that a bad attitude on my part?
Bonner Ritchie.
I'm not going to tell you it's a bad attitude, but there is a realistic dimension to it. But again, the issue is looking at it from both sides. You know, Israelis are fighting a battle of survival. I think they're way overdoing it. I think that there's lots of violations that are very serious. But you don't solve it by avoiding it. You resolve it by dealing with it. And I've spent some time with Shimon Peres, who was twice prime minister of Israel, defense minister, and is currently the president of Israel. He feels that there are a majority, and I don't have precise numbers, but he feels there are clearly a majority of Israelis who want peace and to want to recognize a Palestinian state and want to make peace. There's a small group that need a common enemy. A lot of us need enemies in order to justify our economic or our political power base. There are a lot of people who want to keep it in, both Palestinians and Israelis. Those people need to be talked to. They need to be worked with, not avoided. And so my bias is to get acquainted with people and to bring them together in a variety of contexts. Two Palestinians on the Israeli national soccer team have changed the culture of sports in Israel. A lot of Israelis opposed them at the first. A lot of Palestinians thought they were traitors. But in the long run, when they won, everybody likes the Palestinian players and the Israeli players. So I think the opportunities to work together, even though there are severe problems and serious issues on both sides, I want to stop the rockets flying from Gaza into the Negev, into Israel, and I want to stop the Israeli home destructions. But the very best people for doing that, the best people who are working for the Palestinians are a group of Israeli peacemakers and a group of Palestinians who are working to resolve the conflict with Israel. I want to bring those people together rather than avoid them. So my recommendation is to go meet people and talk and enjoy people and build bridges rather than walls.
Peter, are you persuaded?
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you so much.
Peter, I appreciate the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. So is peace in your mind, is it possible in all of these hotbed places where violence and revenge have been guiding principles for generations and generations? I mean, can you find peace in any environment? Bonner Ritchie.
Yes, but it's not easy. And I don't want to sound Pollyanna. It is difficult, and it's a long-term process. A lot of people want short-term solutions to long-term problems, and you need a long-term strategy. The Oslo Peace Accords were many years ago, but they have changed a culture. They've changed values, and it's going to take many more years. But yes, I think it will happen. I think in the long run, people get tired of conflict. George Mitchell did a wonderful job in Northern Ireland. It took a long time as a peacemaker. And interestingly enough, he used the same metaphor. When asked what he's doing, he takes a picture of a child out of his wallet and he says the kids of Northern Ireland deserve the same opportunities as his children, grandchildren in Maine. He was a well-known senator from Maine and decided to go into the dangerous world of peacemaking. And he did it. He got everybody to represent other people's point of view. He got them to see the children that needed love and rather than revenge, that needed help and education rather than conflict. And I am an optimist. I see enormous opportunities. In the Arab Spring, I see enormous opportunities. Young people saying we need something better. It's going to take a while. Egypt is struggling. Tunisia is doing a little better. And Syria's an absolute tragedy right now. But yes, I think that in every one of these cases, every time I see people, there's a change. I taught at the Jordan Institute of Diplomacy, sort of a State Department type of institution in Jordan. And some of my former students, one is now the chief of staff for the King of Jordan. And these are people who are changing their paradigm, who are changing the paradigm of the larger world. And Jordan is a good example. They've made great progress, and they're a force for peace with Israel, with the surrounding neighbors. They live in a tough neighborhood between Jordan between Israel and Iraq and Syria and Saudi Arabia. But they've done a really good job and will do a better job. But it'll take time, and a lot of us are too impatient. time with with education, bringing kids together, bringing adults together, soccer teams, all kinds of things. But yes, I'm optimistic.
The contention in the Middle East aside, there's plenty of gridlock in our own country right now. You know, issues become so polarized almost immediately, and many have lamented that there's very little interest in a give-and-take negotiating environment in U.S. government today. I'm wondering what advice you would give to U.S. political leaders.
I've
tried. A little closer to home.
I've tried. I've spoken. People don't always listen. Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think that we have sort of devolved into a tragic issue of power struggle rather than peacemaking. I think that we care more about winning than we do about achieving noble ends. And I think that is really sad. I think that the decline of some civil discourse is represented by a lot of jealousy, a lot of resentment, a lot of extremists, a lot of people who feel they would rather be right than effective. And their definition of right often excludes my rights or your rights. And in the process, teaching people a transcendent metaphor for me has become absolutely critical. And I've said before, for me, that transcendent metaphor is children and making the world a better place, not imposing my will, not having an absolutist value system, which is very difficult for extremists. I'm encouraged that the Tea Party's losing influence in Utah, in the world, in the nation. But there's still a lot of people for whom the world of a zealot is a very attractive world. They need a common enemy. They live in a culture of fear, a culture of threat, a culture of anxiety. And the only way to perpetuate that is to have an enemy. And so you've got to circle the wagons and define the rest of the world as an enemy and then strike out, even if you all go down in the process. In Israel, they call it the Masada complex, where the Romans were troubled by the zealots in Masada, the community of 1,000 Jews up at the top of a mountain. And they decided that they would never compromise, they would never surrender, they would all die before they negotiated or gave in. And the Masada complex is a very critical issue. You know, we've got to convince people that dying for a cause is not always the best strategy. Maybe living for a noble purpose is better than dying for an arbitrary principle. So, yeah, I agree, and I don't have an easy answer. I've talked to people a lot of times, but I still argue that we need to work on the metaphors. Building bridges is far more fun than building walls.
You delivered your final public lecture last week at Utah Valley University, but you've retired 3 times before.
Final is in quotes.
In quotes. What are you going to miss most about the classroom?
Well, you know, I'm not going to quit talking, but I am going to quit having a regular class. There's a problem in terms of health and all kinds of variables that make that difficult. But I've learned so much from teaching. I do miss the classroom. I don't miss going to meetings, department meetings. I don't miss university bureaucracies, of which there are a lot of negative consequences. I don't miss grading papers particularly. But I do like to talk. I like to help people. I like to see people change and grow and develop. And so, yeah, this was the last class for an organized academic program. But seeing kids, relative now, you know, 30-year-olds or kids, seeing young people's eyes light up with a new paradigm, a new way of thinking, a new appreciation for a larger world. Lately, I've been teaching cross-cultural issues more than organizational issues, and giving people an inspiration to really look at the world differently is so fun, and I will miss that.
Jay Bonarici. He's a professor emeritus at BYU, also scholar in residence at Utah Valley University. We expect that you will continue to be giving lectures for many years to come. Bonarici, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, an on the ground account of life in Afghanistan. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.